This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
As I mentioned, I do serve as one of the global PIs for the current Lutonix below-the-knee drug-coated balloon study, and also not listed here, but in the past I've worked as an advisory board member for Codavance, another drug-coated balloon that was available in Europe but did not make it to the U.S. So what are our goals for endovascular treatment of CLI? And I posit that everybody here would agree that we want to achieve and maintain the adequate arterial flow to the foot to relieve both pain and heal any wounds that are present or that we're going to create with amputations or debridements. And obviously, I think a heavy surgeon-weighted group here understands the dictum of getting straight line flow to the foot. Of interest is that there is a reasonable amount of data suggesting an additional benefit for direct angiosome revascularization, particularly in instances where the foot collaterals are interrupted, and so where those end arteries really do act as end arteries. And as has been emphasized a couple different times this morning, we know that we can achieve pretty reasonable primary patency rates in the superficial femoral artery. So when we consider the treatment of critical limb ischemia, how often are we going to be moving into the distal popliteal and tibial vessels to achieve that adequate flow? Well, I'll bounce us back to some of the surgical data, and this is a project that Mike Conti spearheaded for the SVS. And we looked at different surgical trial data and gathered that in, including his PREVENT 3 trial, the CIRCULATE trial, and the BASIL trial from the UK. And looking at the site of the distal graft outflow, it's at the distal popliteal and infrapopliteal location. In the first two, the majority of the time, 66%, 54%, a minority in basal, and I would suggest that's because if you look at the bottom here, the basal trial had a panel review where there needed to be equipoise between radiologists and surgeons involving if these lesions could be randomized to interventional treatment versus surgical bypass. That took place in the early 2000s. I think the comfort level was there for more proximal leg interventions, not so much in all cases for the distal, so I think that tended to weight this towards more proximal interventions for the basal trial. So we're working distally to achieve that result. How do we do with plain balloon angioplasty to start the discussion? Well, looking at some reasonable data here, a nice meta-analysis from Romedy from Journal of Vascular Surgery at infrapopliteal plain balloon angioplasty, primary patency about 58% at 1 year. Of course, limb salvage always exceeds those patency rates substantially. I picked another good kind of well-conducted single-center retrospective look from the Deaconess. Almost identical results there in terms of the primary patency and limb salvage. And then I think a nice, really honest paper, which you don't get too often, from Andre Schmidt in Europe, looking at plain balloon angioplasty for long lesions. These were, as I recall, about 17-centimeter lesions with absolutely horrid primary patency at 3 months down to 31%. I mean, you barely have time to wheel the patient out and wheel them back in. Nonetheless, limb salvage was really excellent throughout that study. So it shows, again, the dissociation between patency rates and limb salvage, but also shows that as we deal with these challenging long lesions, that certainly we don't have much of an expectation for durable patency with plain balloon angioplasty. So if our goal is to modify the intimal hyperplasia process, we're targeting smooth muscle cell proliferation and migration. And as we know, the coronary drug-eluting stent has been successful, multiple platforms, multiple different agents. If we look down in the tibials in terms of what we used as bailouts for our plain balloon angioplasty, there was a very quietly conducted study of the Abbott Expert stent. This is a very delicate little nitinol self-expanding stent that travels through a 4 French platform. And a trial was conducted looking at this as a potential tibial bailout stent, and it was just kind of disappointing. The patency rates, primary patency, I think, was just under 50% a year, if I'm remembering correctly. And that kind of faded away. But in the interim, to kind of take us off that drug-coated balloon track for a moment, studies, single-center experiences using coronary drug-eluting stents in the tibials began to pop up. And these have progressed and culminated with a couple of primarily European trials looking at the Achilles trial, which randomized the sirolimus drug-eluting stent versus plain balloon angioplasty. And then again, I think it's always interesting when you get to randomize against your same stent framework with the drug on it, kind of similar to that Zilver PTX. So the DESTINY trial looked at the Zion stent with and without everolimus coating and showed a nice improvement in terms of the primary patency rates at 1 year, except that these are coronary stents, right? So we're talking about very focal lesions. The cost goes up substantially if we start looking at trying to treat longer segments. We really don't have data in terms of stacking multiple coronary stents for longer segments. And so the applicability to the broader CLI population is probably going to be substantially limited. So that brings us around to the topic of drug-coated balloons. And if we look at this, it really, I've not found a paper that really comes out and says it, but it seems, my initial impression when I saw these papers first come out was I couldn't believe it. It seems so unlikely that a single inflation could deliver a pharmacologically active and appropriately sustained dose to the tissue. So the whole concept with that drug-eluting stent was that it eluted. It sat there and slowly released its medication over a month or longer to produce that desired result. And how in the heck could you accomplish that with just a single pop of a balloon? So I think it really came down to a certain extent, and maybe they are just geniuses, but I think a little bit of fortuitous choice of using iopromide, which is a contrast agent, to solubilize paclitaxel. These investigators have been looking at trying to solubilize paclitaxel within the contrast as they inject in the leg to see if that would modify the response. And they use that to coat the balloons. Well, it turns out that that contrast agent actually was not maybe the best, but a decent excipient. And so that got the process started, because what happens when you then inflate that balloon against the wall is that you create a luminal depot of the drug with just a single brief inflation. And so that allows you to create sustained tissue levels. They're not quite as high as drug-eluting stents, but they can mimic that drug-eluting stent curve in terms of having some active drug for several weeks after your inflation. So here, this is a Lutonic slide when they've used an Oregon green stain to label the paclitaxel that gets sent off transferred from the balloon to the vessel wall. What's even more impressive, if you look at those original, that process went on to become the Cotovance balloon in Europe. And if you look at the transfer of drug with Cotovance, it really comes off in hunks. I mean, it creates these big kind of chunky depots underneath underneath the intima there. And that really creates that nice depot effect where it provides its own little reservoir within the vessel wall that's going to create that drug concentration. So we do want these to be effective anti-proliferative agents. As mentioned before, paclitaxel is the only one currently being investigated, but there's a couple of the different Lemus drugs that could be potentially investigated as well. But then you really face this push and pull of, you want it to be stable and adherent during the storage of the balloon on the shelf, during your prep on the table, and particularly you want to be able to get it from point A at the sheath through the diaphragm of the sheath, not scrape it off, down through the blood vessel with flowing blood or within your sheath with liquid in it, down to that site without releasing all of its medication. Then suddenly you want it to do the magic of releasing it all at once against the vessel wall cleanly without embolizing. And to do that, you want to certainly have a lipophilic property there. And then produce the therapeutic tissue levels for several weeks, preferably about a month out. Also, of course, to make the FDA happy, you've got to have minimal systemic release and have minimal toxicity both locally and systemically. The latter is really not an issue. The total dose here that we're giving is fairly trivial in any of these drug-coated balloon trials. So all the current formulations, you use the paclitaxel, it's lipophilic, it is capable of rapid absorption. Really, a lot of the differences here are in the balloon, in the coating process, and in the excipients. So iopromide is the first one that was utilized. The free pack from Medtronic is primarily urea-based. Lutonix uses a combination of polysorbate and sorbitol as their excipients. Let's take a look back at and kind of come forward, primarily looking at European data because they get all the toys before us, but kind of come from 6 years ago up to present and see how this is influencing our study designs. The Thunder trial, Gunnar Tepe, published in New England Journal, looked at SFA lesions, over 150 patients, and this is the one where they were randomizing to the drug-coated balloons, and then they also looked at whether or not putting the paclitaxel in the contrast media created any good effect. The answer is it didn't. But it was a double-blinded study, and it showed a late lumen loss advantage for the drug-coated balloon, a TLR advantage. And they even went back and took a look at dissections, and it seemed that healing of dissections was better in the drug-coated balloon group, which is kind of the thing you'd like to see, because if we're going to move away from stent implants, you want to have the sense of security that perhaps you're going to see favorable healing when you leave that raggedy-looking arterial surface behind. the Pacifier trial, looking at the Medtronic Impact platform. Looked at balloon versus plain balloon angioplasty, followed out to 6 months. Again, the same advantages, late lumen loss, binary restenosis rates, 8% for the drug-coated versus 32% for plain balloon angioplasty, and a TLR advantage. That's important, and we'll kind of talk about that as I get into some of the Levant data. So Levant 2 protocol, predilation, it's, forget who mentioned it earlier, but it is important in this. You don't want to be scraping off your drug on the surface of the wall. So knowing that you're going to win from a luminal standpoint before you ever commit to the balloon is where this is going. So if you failed predilation in the Levant 2 study, you got moved over to the suboptimal PTA group. You received basically treatment per the institutional preference, and you were followed out for 30 days for safety and no longer included. Assuming you got a successful predilation where there is a 70% patency of the lumen, you then could be randomized 2-to-1 to the test arm versus control and followed out to 12 months. So their roll-in, they had their 540 patients, about 50-odd roll-in patients. Great majority of patients got randomized. What's nice to see is how few patients actually failed that predilatation. So really, this suggests that the great mass of these kind of similar lesions would be amenable to treatment with this. There wasn't a high dropout rate on the table from in terms of the predilatation. Safety endpoints were similar between the test and plain balloon angioplasty arms out to 6 months here. They did see an advantage by Kaplan-Meier in the patency. It kind of pulls a little further on, but this has to do with when the study visits are conducted as well in terms of when the lines start to separate out. This was a topic of a lot of discussion, the fact that they didn't, at 6 months, see an advantage in TLR. And so the issue has been brought up of, it's, you know, is it enough just to have a patency advantage? Do we also want to have a benefit to the patient? Well, absolutely we do. TLR is a relatively soft endpoint. I think it matters, but it's something to look at it with a grain of salt. It's patient-dependent. It's certainly investigator-dependent in a trial as to how that happens. But in a truly blinded trial, to not have a difference is a little bit concerning. The way they did this, as Peter had mentioned, was to not count bailout stents against the patency rates here, or the TLR rates. They didn't count it as an automatic TLR. The bailout stents were actually higher in the plain balloon angioplasty arm, so it would have pushed the lines apart to significance, and I think as they go out to 12 months, they're seeing that the lines do continue to separate out there. So if we look at the other secondary endpoints at 6 months, the binary restenosis rates, as I mentioned, there are significantly different. Other than that, the safety endpoints and death and amputation are all quite low. Only one amputation that was in the drug-coated arm not felt to be related to the process. So what about infrapopliteal drug-coated balloons? So recall that I talked about that nice, honest study that Dr. Schmidt did looking at his long balloon angioplasty result where they had that patency rate of only 31% at 3 months. Well, he got his hands on the impact balloon and went back and looked at a similar group, obviously not randomized. This is 2 to 3 years down the line, but similar length of lesion. And with the DCB cohort, had primary patency rates of 73% over the same time. So without being randomized, it certainly suggested a positive signal there, and had amputation rates for these patients who were, I think, about 80% CLI and only 20% claudication, had amputation rates of less than 5%. The DEBATE BTK study was another study that created a lot of enthusiasm for drug-coated balloons. This was a single-center Italian study, and this is looking at actually restenosis rates. So in this setting, you want your bar to be lower rather than higher. So the lighter bars are the test arm of the impact Amphirion deep balloon versus plain balloon angioplasty. So in a bunch of different breakouts there, looking at per-patient analysis, breaking it down by lesion, by certain lesion length, the presence of occlusion, whether or not intraluminal or subintimal recanalization was used. Across the board, there was a nice sustained signal in favor of the drug-coated balloons when they looked at restenosis rates. So what went wrong? So those of you who follow this know that in January we had the first presentation. There's not yet a publication of the IMPACT Deep trial. This was a European prospective multicenter randomized controlled trial. all the usual bells and whistles that we would associate with an attempt at eventual market indication in the U.S. because this was going to be data that was to be submitted to the FDA. So independent core lab, appropriate adjudication of events, 2-to-1 randomization from the drug-coated balloon to POBA, a good number of patients, 230 in the drug arm, 119 in the plain balloon arm. There were some, I think, relative, I wouldn't say exceptions, but interesting choices in the protocol that I think perhaps reflected the enthusiasm that existed based on that single center data. So they allowed Rutherford 6. That always makes me kind of wince a little bit, because if you actually read the old Rutherford document, the Rutherford 6 is the limb you think you can't salvage. So why that ever gets put in a protocol escapes me. And because of that, I think there's a lot of vagueness as to what that means in terms of wound inclusion. Also, for a portion of the patients enrolled in the trial, CKD and even end-stage renal disease was acceptable. Lesion length was unlimited. Runoff could be via collaterals rather than defined straight-line flow from the treated vessel across the ankle. And lastly, I've talked once about the complex wounds. When I look at the breakdown from Tom Zeller's slides, they marked that 20% of the wounds are at or above the level of the ankle. So I'm not sure if that means that these were simply very advanced, if there were a lot of combined neuropathic or venous wounds also being included under the same umbrella. But it does, to me, as a outside observer who was not involved in that trial and doesn't have access to their source data, it makes it difficult for me to interpret the failure rates or to do a real failure analysis. What we do know, though, from Dr. Zeller's presentation is that there really wasn't an appropriate biologic activity signal. They failed to meet their primary efficacy endpoints. There was no difference, critically, no difference in late lumen loss, so we really didn't see that change in the blood vessel we were hoping for, or TLR or occlusion rates. There was a non-significant trend towards higher amputation rates in the drug-coated balloon arm, and even prior to that presentation, Medtronic made the decision to remove the product from the market in Europe. So, makes for some sleepless nights for the guy running the drug-coated balloon trial here in the U.S. We are running the Lutonix below-the-knee trial. It's a global trial. It also involves lots of European sites and some Japanese sites. So we're going to enroll 480 patients at 55 global sites. Duplex ultrasound is our primary mode of follow-up at most of the visits. We are going to get angiography in everyone who's not renally insufficient at 12 months. My co-investigators, Jihad Mustafa, and in Austria, Marianne Broadman. Safety, periprocedural death at 30 days and then major adverse limb events. Efficacy, we're looking at a composite of limb salvage and primary patency at 12 months. The inclusion criteria are fairly similar. I think perhaps some of the differences, and these were all choices made before the Impact Deep came out, is that we're looking at similar vessel sizes. Everybody wants the inflow to be patent. We are mandating that the target vessels reconstitute and traverse the ankle as a single patent vessel, so it's not kind of a wispy collateral runoff. Important on the exclusion side is that we currently exclude wounds proximal to the toes. The study is enrolling quite slowly. There's a lot of active debate about this. This is really based on the work that Joe Mills did looking at the SVS Wi-Fi, which was kind of bubbling up in the background as we were writing the protocol for this study. And what was very clear at that time is that we just lack the capacity to really adequately stratify wounds and their impact on expected amputation rates. So as we really dive in deeply and start looking at critical limb ischemia approval trials, knowing what a wound predicts is the number one question with a bullet for me, and I still don't have a good answer. Our SVS Wi-Fi system is based on a Delphi, like an expert consensus panel, really not on hard data. So we're moving in the right direction. I don't think we're fully there yet. The Wi-Fi is a big improvement on Rutherford. But this still leaves us in a somewhat awkward position as trialists as not having the firm footing in data that you would prefer there. We're going to randomize 2-to-1. We are permitting retrograde wire access, but not treatment through that retrograde sheath. The balloon lengths are fairly substantial, so I think it will mimic real-life data in terms of lesion lengths that could be treated, all the usual both ultrasound and angiographic core labs and all the secondary endpoints you could ever wish for. The trial protocol itself looks very similar to Levant, not surprisingly. I think what's even more critical in the tibials is this pre-dil. You've got small vessels, heavy calcification. The tolerances as compared to feeding a collapsed balloon down through an SFA are much greater here. So I think the capacity for an unfavorable interaction between balloon and vessel wall is certainly there. So this is something to take away for your practice even down the road if these things get on market. Suboptimal PTA will get the same treatment. Successful predilatations will be randomized in the study to the test arm versus the control arm. So where do we conclude? What seemed like a sure thing a year or two ago is really now back under the microscope. We have a slowly enrolling and sometimes frustrating trial, but I think our initial choices for protocol hopefully will bear out and at least give us a clear answer as to the efficacy and safety of this platform. I think everybody who treats CLI is really interested to see if this can take that patency line and move it up and maybe move salvage lines up along with it, but it's going to require some nice hard-fought data to answer the question. So hopefully a couple years down the line I'll have a different presentation for you. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.